The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1 with Elavon Merchant Services. Growing your business is easy peasy with us by your side.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Executive Director of Eurosong, Michael Keeley, kicked off Eurovision season ahead of a special Late Late Show on February 4th. I spoke to Barbara Shanahan, who swapped digital marketing for bus driving at the height of the pandemic. Speaking of career changes, Chef Niamh Condon told me about how working in a nursing home helped her to rediscover passion in her job. Gabriel Gatehouse talked to me about looking beyond the headlines at QAnon and the storming of the Capitol building on January 6th last year. And Dubliner Glenn Keogh joined me from LA to chat about adding some authentic Irish charm to the latest season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you like it. Michael Keeley, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
Michael, you're the executive director of Eurosong and you've kind of taken a swerve in the road now back to the loving arms of the Late Late Show on the 4th of February. Tell us what's the deal and what brought you to us, as it were.
It's a bit like football coming home, Ryan, isn't it? I mean, it's coming back to the Late Late Show. It's a while since we've done a Eurosong. I think it's 2015 or 2016, I think was the last time we did a Eurosong.
Right.
We just, like, every year we would, you know, obviously we would look at what we've done the previous year. We've looked at how we've fared and we look at to see what we could do better, what we could do different. So we kind of took a different tack after that last Eurosong. It was a very memorable Eurosong, as you remember. So we decided this year just to go back to it. You know, we just had an open competition. We got over 330 songs and we've whittled them down through an exhaustive process to the six that you're going to hear this week.
Okay. Is it exhausting listening to all those songs?
If you ever try to sit down and listen to 330 songs in a row, it is quite the task, let me just tell you that. And it wasn't one that I undertook on my own. You'll be glad to hear.
I am glad to
it can be difficult, you know, because you can't listen to them like straight, you know, you can't listen to 330 straight. So you have to listen to a few, you have to go away, think about them, come back, listen to a few more and get a sense of you know what they are and whether they could do well potentially for us in Eurovision.
And what I get the impression from watching it over the years, Michael, is that the Eurovision family, community, whatever you want to call them, feels this great sense of ownership of the phenomenon that is the Eurovision. And by this I mean that people who want to enter a competition like this to win the song for Ireland and then ultimately represent Ireland, they come from all over the world to write these songs. Like the list of composers for that first song, you know, it's an international flavour.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it's reflective of the way the music industry is now, you know. So technology obviously has allowed people to collaborate across great distances. So you get a lot of Irish songwriters who would collaborate with people in Sweden or would collaborate with people in, you know, Germany or in America or even in Australia. So they would get together and you would often find, I mean, very, very few songs that come in these days to Eurovision are written solely by one person. They're generally speaking, they're collaborations, you know. They're all very passionate, they're all very committed about it, and they're all very keen on doing well, which is great, you know.
Why have we just not done well enough in recent years? You're asked this question every year, and no, but it is hard. I'm not trying to be smart. What is it? Like we always have an excuse. It's kind of like, oh well, you know, no one likes Ireland anymore. Or Brexit, or you know, there's always an excuse to hand. What are we going to do this time that will enhance our chances?
Just to sort of set the record straight. I mean, we haven't done great, I suppose, in the last few years, that's true. But if you were to take it over the last, say, 10 years, you know, or 11 years, like we've qualified maybe five times in 11 years, which is pretty much representative of, an average country. You know, because
an average country, Michael Keeley. We are the Eurovision supremos. You can't put us in average.
I appreciate that, Ryan. I appreciate the passion you bring to it.
As I will do on the 4th of February.
As you should do, yeah.
As I will.
But our experience now is like the rules changed around the end of the 90s, and that kind of sort of mitigated against us really, because they introduced semi-finals, which, so they made people qualify for the final, where previously there was an automatic qualification to the final.
Yeah.
Everybody can sing in English beforehand, you know, only two or three countries were allowed to sing in English. So the rules have changed. In a way, it's an entirely different competition to the one that we were winning in the 90s, not to detract from any of our great winners.
No, and everyone gave it a fair whack, in fairness.
Yeah, so, there are 43 countries involved. So, I mean, if you were to take the law of averages, it would be once every 43 years that we would win, you know. So I suppose it has become tougher, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, look, I think every year we go with what we hope will be the best shot.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Okay, and that brings us to the 4th of February, and people listening this morning will have a vested interest in it because they can vote.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a combination of
there's going to be a national jury, an international jury, and a public vote.
All right, okay.
So the national jury, obviously, people will be familiar with. The international jury, I think, is a new innovation, just in that because it's an international competition, it is worthwhile hearing what other European countries,
yeah,
and people in other European countries think of our entry, you know. It's something that a lot of countries abroad do. Sweden do it, Norway do it, various other countries do it as well. So it is something I thought we'd just try again. Like, you know, we're always trying to innovate, we're always trying to do something different, we're always trying to enhance our chances. So we thought we'd introduce the international jury this year.
All right. We've got the six songs that we're showcasing this week. We've just heard Rachel Goods. We're going to play Brendan Murray's in a second. Michael, I have never been to the Eurovision Song Contest.
Ryan, you should go, and I have been telling you for many years that you should go. It is an extraordinary entertainment event. You mentioned to yourself there, it's bigger than the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
It's the largest, biggest live music event in the world. You know.
How many times have you been?
I think I've been about 10, I think.
10. And when you get back on the plane and you leave on your way home, whatever about this disappointment or everything like that, don't mind that for a second. But what is the joy that you get when you're packing your case?
Well, there's a certain joy about coming home after 2 weeks anywhere.
Yeah.
Just being part of it, you mentioned yourself, there's a kind of a community, there's a sort of a spirit that Eurovision fans bring to the event as well, which is like nothing you'd experience anywhere else, you know. So there's a great sense of camaraderie, there's a great collegiality between ourselves and colleagues in other broadcasters around Europe, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a very feel good event, you know. There's nothing in it that you wouldn't like, you know.
Okay, so now that we've invested in this, we probably should do the radio show from there.
It is essential, yeah. Absolutely.
I think it would be essential travel, if nothing else, in Turin. I'd love to go. It's one of those experiences, broadcast experiences I've never had, and I'd love to see it up close and in real life.
All the greats, you know yourself, Terry Wogan was there for many, many years. Larry Gogan, our own Larry Gogan, was there for many years. Marty, of course, is the longest serving commentator in Eurovision now.
Okay.
So we have a certain stature there, Ryan, that I think you'd bring a certain something
I'd
to.
I'd be happy to reduce it with every minute I spend there. Let me see. Ryan says a text from Mary. We need something totally different and maybe go for our own traditional songs. It doesn't matter if we win or not. At least we are celebrating our own culture. Do you factor that in?
To be honest, it's a global pop music contest, really. So you have to enter something you can enter something that you know isn't going to win, but is going to showcase your culture.
Yeah.
But there's not much point in doing that because we're in there to try and actually compete. We're trying to get to the final, and then ultimately we're trying to do well and possibly win it. You know, so all the songs are chosen with the view to doing well. You know, and if a song comes in the door that has that X factor, that is, you know, a typical trad arrangement or a typical Irish song or whatever, or even if it's in Irish, more than happy to consider it, you know.
What's the name of the young lad who's running around with a fiddle? Very nice fiddle. We had him on the late then afterwards. He won it.
Oh, he's the Norwegian guy.
Yes.
Yeah, he won it about 10 years ago. I can't do
that. No, but that name doesn't matter so much. But that was, you know, that was a fiddle. I mean, in other words, there can be an appetite for
For ethnic music,
ethnic music is the word, yeah.
Well, it is, but ethnic music combined with, it has to have a kind of a universal appeal to it as
So a blend of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I mean that was a great pop tune, you know, and that's one of the things I suppose that we look for is something that's going to be a great pop tune, something that would do well on radio, regardless of the Eurovision, you know, something that you think would be a hit and anyway, because like the songs that are entered now are songs that would be hits around Europe in any case, you know.
Alexander Rybak for 2 points.
That's the very man.
But that was on the tip of your tongue anyway, wasn't it?
It was.
My three friends and I, says the text, are going to Turin for the Eurovision. We were in Lisbon in 2018 and booked for Rotterdam, which didn't happen. So obviously a lot of people are excited. Hopefully, again, because we should mention that, it'll be a lot more freedom of movement by the time we get to Italy in May. Emer was on, just wondering if anyone in Ireland has a take on the show, how the show is viewed in Italy. I live in Milan and don't hear about it in the media. The annual San Remo is highly watched show.
The San Remo contest is what decides the Eurovision, as far as I know, the Eurovision entry. So the one that won in Rotterdam last year, Manskin, are absolutely huge now. They're a global phenomenon. You know, they were top 10 in the United States. They've had top 10 hits all over the world. They're filling out arenas everywhere. I think they're on Saturday Night Live in the US on this Saturday. They're enormous. So the sort of benefits of winning Eurovision are huge to an act.
Not to be underestimated.
Not at all.
Eilish and Bray says it would be interesting if no country sang in English, not even us. Maybe the English, but that's just another take on that. Another says, that first song, very 1980s vibe on first hearing, at least. It's a more open competition, which can only help chance. There's a lot of text coming in on that, saying that people are glad to see that it's gone back out to the public vote. So I think there'll be a big response to that. And I hope, says another, the Divine Comedy are special guests on the Late Late to sing their most infamous Eurovision song. Well, of course, you know, you have to have a sense of humour too. All right, Michael, how are you feeling? You feeling hopeful about this Ireland's chances this year?
I think we've got six very, very good songs.
Okay.
Very happy with the selection we have. And, I would be happy nearly with any of them. Whichever one the public and the juries pick to go to Italy in May, I'd be more than happy with.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you in Italy in May. And
probably see you before then.
Well, you never know. I'm just trying to get the suitcase bought outside here and see if we can move that along. But in the meantime, Executive Director of Eurosong, Michael Keely, good to talk to you. Thanks for your time this morning.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
24 minutes past 9. Barbara Shanahan, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
Nice.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Nice to talk to you. Before the job we're about to discuss came up and into your life, what were you doing? I suppose pre-pandemic, let's say. What was happening in your world?
Well, pre-pandemic, I was actually self-employed. I had three small kids, so I was working from home, had a little home office set up and was managing, you know, the children's day-to-day and clients doing digital marketing, campaigns, things like that.
Okay.
So very much in the house and sort of, you know, just doing day-to-day tasks with the kids and that, yeah.
And the nature of your clientele?
Well, I was hospitality. So it was bars and restaurants doing Facebook for them, campaigns like that, and social media, websites.
And along came...
And along came COVID, yeah.
And we know the hospitality business have just taken probably more hits than most when it comes to this thing. And
well, I lost all my clients basically overnight. I lost, like, my entire business just went because everything closed. And, of course, that was the end of that, you know.
Could you see it falling off the cliff?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah,
the cliff was bang, they're gone. But thank God, like, the PUP payment was there. So at least that was, you know, you weren't left kind of completely rudderless, should we say, you know.
All right. So you had you have the three kids. There was a slight change of circumstances. You moved. Where did you move then?
I'm in Dublin. I'm based in Dublin. Yeah, but we spent the pandemic down in West Cork. So we got stuck down there for a few weeks. When everything locked down.
You could do worse than being stuck in West Cork, couldn't you?
It was a good place to be stuck because the weather was incredible and it was so quiet and beautiful and it was actually a really nice time to just be together and just kind of take your foot off the pedal a bit. So it actually was lovely.
Good. And you find yourself then, you know, the payment is fine, and some people probably enjoyed that and enjoyed not being at work, and some people said, no, I want to be at work. It's driving me mad. I want to do something. I think you fell into the latter category. And you were you looking around actively, or did it come out of the skies?
Well, at that time, what happened was I saw this double-decker bus passing by on Griffith Avenue, and it had a big sign on it saying, looking for female bus drivers.
I've seen those ads, actually. Very striking.
So it was like, come and have a go at driving the bus. And I thought, geez, that looks like fun. Actually, I'm going to do that for the crack. So I just sent in an email and I said, you know, I'm interested in coming to the open day, which was in Phibsborough Garage there. And I went in, and that was the start of this journey that I'm on now.
What, had you any idea as a kid, as a young person, or, you know, even as an adult, that driving a bus might be an option at all, or an ambition?
To be honest, no. I mean, I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would or could drive a massive double-decker bus. It was never really on my remit. But I mean, I remember, like, I grew up in Marino and I still live here now with the kids that go to the local schools. And I remember as a kid, like, being on the top circle there and asking the bus driver for bus rolls. That was a big thing. I don't know if you remember that.
Is this a conductor's roll of paper, is it?
Yeah, no? You'd ask for the bus rolls, and we were mad for these bus rolls, and they'd throw out a bus roll and you'd be, yay, you'd be so delighted. Like, the bus drivers were so sound, and they always were happy, and, like, you always respected the bus. The bus was, like, to be respected. And I remember, like, the 24 route coming around Marino. I remember the imps, and they had the city imp, but then they went back to the double-decker because it was too busy. And, like, you always respected. I always had great respect for Dublin Bus and for the drivers and that. So, yeah, but I never, in my wildest dreams, thought I could drive a double-decker bus.
Okay,
I am.
There you are. Let's go to the open day. And there you are, like, your first day at school. What sort of people showed up? I mean, was it a mix and gathering of...
All women, because it was specifically, they were trying to recruit women at that stage. It was a specific sort of female recruitment day. So you went and you actually got to go driving the bus around the yard, around like the bus depot yard, which was great fun. We were all kind of squealing and taking photos of each other. And, you know, that was great fun. And there was a guy, one of the guys, you know, they've got the dual controls, so, you know, you can't crash into stuff. And then they brought us up to the comms room, so the communication room, which is up in Broadstone Depot, where they control everything. And you can see the whole city. And it's really impressive. You know, it's a much bigger operation than you'd ever think from getting on the bus every day going into town, you know.
Yeah.
And what struck me was that everyone was there donkey's years. They were there 18, 20, 45 years. Like, they were there forever. Nobody left.
Yeah, it's a good
sign.
And
they were also... And they were all so happy. They were so happy. They were cheerful. They were having the crack with each other. And they were like, oh, you know, I drove the bus for 15 years and now I came up here and now I'm in charge of this and this is the part. And I thought, that's amazing. So there's career progression, you know. You can move through the company and stay with the company. And a few of them were like, oh, you know, we never left and it's a great, great company, great job, you love it, you know. And that was really encouraging. And just chatting with, I just picked everyone's brain. I was chatting with everyone, finding out as much as I could, because then I really thought, this is actually a viable option. I could actually work for this company. This is like, and that's basically the only job I went for after COVID hit and everything. This is the only job I went for, and I went for it. I really like got into it, and I said, I'm going to get this. The process is.
I will ask a quick question, if I may, which is just dying to know the size of the steering wheel. And then, the bulk of what's above you and behind you. I'm trying to sit there for a minute in my head, going, I'd be freaked out by the enormity of it all.
I know, it is a bit scary, but the thing is that the training is so good that, you know, you're completely protected for the first. Your training is 7 weeks. You're brought in at the start, and you're on the big red bus, and it's literally like a massive learner sign, like, so everybody knows. This person doesn't know how to drive a bus, so be careful, you know.
Yeah.
So you don't leave the yard for the first few days. You're just going around the yard, practicing stopping, pulling in, getting the sense of the size of it, because you have to have your license anyway. So you have to have your B license anyway and have a minimum of 2 years driving experience anyway.
Yes.
And obviously no endorsements and all that. So you have to, you know, be a competent driver. And then you're driving around the yard and then you're out on the road and you're it's all very steady. There's only during COVID when we were training, there was only two of us. And an instructor. So you're getting a lot of driving time and all your training is given. You're completely covered. You have a bad day. It's okay. They're so nice. They're so kind. Like, and they understand how daunting it can be. And, you know, if you don't know how to do it, you just stop and start again. And it's actually really good. So it's 7 weeks of full training.
Yeah.
So they don't let you go into it unless they don't let you out unless you're absolutely competent and able. Like, and the training is excellent. Like, it's world class. Like, and they've won awards for it and everything. And I really felt confident going to my depot when I was finished my training. I passed my test first time, and you go up and they walk you. Thank you. They walk you through that, and you do that up in, we did it up just off Glasnevin there, and they bring you around the test routes all the way. So you're doing test routes the whole time before you do your test. So, you know, it's familiar, and you know the corners, and you know the curbs and the roundabouts and stuff like that. So it's very much geared towards passing the test and then training you how to be a Dublin bus driver. And then you do a huge customer service course, which is really, really good. That was really interesting. And that was in town. So, like, it's such a great buzz because you're there, like, in the middle of town and you're doing your classes, then going off for lunch, and all your lunch is paid for. You get lunch to training for free. They give you a bus pass straight away for free so you can get to and from. Like, you have your bus pass from day one. You know, so it's fantastic. Like, I really enjoyed the training.
You sound like you're really happy with your new world. I'm enjoying your enthusiasm for it, I have to say.
I am.
So do you have a route now? Are you a bus driver?
I am officially a professional bus driver, Ryan.
And where can we see you, or what's the...
Well, you can see me waving and smiling. I was on the 1-2-3 on Sunday, and actually it's amazing because that's my route. I live in Marina, so it was like really surreal driving around the circles, waving at people I knew and saying hi to people I knew. You don't get a specific route, you see, until you're there for a long time. So I'm based out of Summerhill, which means I do all the routes from Summerhill.
Yeah.
So your routes change different day, but I do a 4-day week. So to me, it's fantastic. Like, I'm here with the kids every morning. I do a 4-day long weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I work four shifts. That's my week done. And then off Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know? So for me to have that balance with my children and with my life and being able to see people and get everything done around the house and actually be here every weekday morning is fantastic. Like, for women and for me at this stage, it just fitted in so well. There's no pressure. Go in, you drive your bus, you leave. You know, there's no emails, no things to check. No,
it sounds, you know, you're setting it so well. I know you're not trying to say this in a pitch, but you just seem, you know, this
yeah,
is...
No, it's great.
You hear about the great resignation that's happening around the world. People have said, I am fed up. I've got a taste of what it's like to not be in the office, or I've got a taste of something different. I'm out of here. COVID has changed my life. And in some ways, it has changed your life.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I don't know if I would have done this if COVID hadn't happened. But, you know, everything happens for a reason, I think. And, you know, if it's meant for you, it won't pass you. But I think, like, personally for women and for people, and I think, like, that sometimes there's women that are in a situation where maybe they've been at home with kids for the last 10, 15 years and they don't know what to do and they're not sure what to do. And you think... You know, it can be hard going back to what you did 10, 15 years ago, or you don't know, and you want a bit of independency and a bit of, you know, financial independence. And I think, you know what, you can do it. Full training given. Everyone can do it. Like, it's a great... They're actually recruiting at the moment, so they're looking for drivers.
What percentage of Dublin bus drivers are women at the moment, roughly?
Well, you see, at the moment, it was only 3% when they did that female recruitment drive.
Okay.
So I think it may be 10% now, but I'm not exactly sure.
All right.
But there's a lot more women on the road now, and they're so respectful and kind. Like, and you go in and it's obviously, like, predominantly male. So sometimes that can be a bit, you know, you feel a little bit like, you know, you're outnumbered, but they're very respectful. Everyone's really nice. You sit down beside someone at the canteen. How are you getting on? How are you doing? How's your day going? Like, there's no... strange. It's like they're so nice. They're so welcoming. They're so friendly.
What walks of life were the other trainees coming from?
You would get people that were taxi drivers. You'd get a lot of people from different bus companies. You get a lot of people that are professional drivers elsewhere and that just want better pay conditions. They pay very well. There's really good benefits because it's such a large company. It's CIE. It's owned by CIE, so you get a lot of benefits. You do a 12-month probationer, you see, and then after the 12 months, all these pension, all these kind of illness benefit and everything kicks in. So it's a very secure job in a very unsecure world. And that, to me, was a huge draw that I feel, okay, I can actually just relax a bit now. I feel really confident that, like, I'm doing this, I'm getting paid every week, I can move on with my career if I want. If I want to do a course, they financially help you. You know, they'll help you with education fees and that.
It's such a world apart.
Opportunities.
Exactly. It's such a world apart, Barbara, from the description of you at the laptop,
you know,
pretty much driving your own bus, in a manner of speaking, and, you know, watching the business fall away as COVID came in and hospitality, you know, just withering on the vine. And for you to be talking, you know, to me, talking to you this morning gives me the feel for us coming out of this thing. I think your story is great. I think it just shows, it gives me hope that you know, even if it was a dark time for people, that, you know, you can turn the corner. You can see better options. You can see the future. You can see the world opening up again.
That's what I love about it, is kind of you have that independence where you're actually driving your own bus. You're actually the boss of that bus. So it's like, so, you know, I'm in charge of that bus. That's my route. That's my job. So I'm basically self-employed, for like, as in I'm by myself on that. But you have then the security of the big company. You have the security of the Dublin bus over you. So you press, if there's a problem, you press the button, you let them know what's happened. Or like, so I'd be really like aware of people with disabilities or elderly people getting on the bus. And I'd be very much like, you know, can you move out of those seats, please? Can you go upstairs and make sure? And people are really appreciative of that. They're so like, thanks a million. Thank you, driver. You know, people are so nice. And that's actually, funnily, their new campaign for recruiting drivers is like, get thanked for a living.
Right.
Because you do. You get thanked all the time. And the kids are waving at you. It's so cute. Like.
Yeah.
And I think about where I was there up in my office, you know, in my corner, in my office, running to the supermarket, running home, back on emails at 8 o'clock, you know, in the evening, back on, just trying to balance everything. And I feel like I'm in my city now. I'm driving through the city. I feel so free and happy. And like, you know, it's just such a change in attitude and lifestyle and a whole like connection to the city that I missed. Because, and before even I was in digital marketing self-employed, was I was in hospitality for years. So I worked in restaurants and bars. That's how I went into, you know, online hospitality, because I saw that there was a gap in the market there of that the restaurants didn't know how to do technological stuff. So I ended up reskilling in a digital marketing course. But before that, I was physically in restaurants, serving, waiting tables, hosting and that. So I really missed that customer base, being out and about chatting. Like, I really missed it. Well, I felt very confined.
I can hear that in you, and in a good way. And there's a lot of support for you coming in. Not just support, admiration. Rachel says, I'm training for my test at the moment. I'm so excited to hear Barbara this morning. So that's great news. Another says,
oh, well, best of luck to her.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks for the amazing flashback from Marino of asking for bus rolls. Very happy memories. What a great woman. Hopefully see her on the 1, 2, 3 soon.
Oh, brilliant.
Please ask Barbara.
Another great memory that I actually just remembered there was, and I'd say a good few people will remember this if they're of my age, is on the Fairview footbridge. There's a footbridge over Fairview there. And I remember as a kid, vividly remember going into Fairview Park over the footbridge. And when the bus would come along, you'd run up. And when the bus would come along, you'd jump just as the bus passed under the bridge.
Okay.
And I bet you loads of people will remember that, because like, you'd do it all the time. I remember posting a video of my kids doing it. And they were like, oh my God, you remember jumping over the buses on
They're all remembering it. Ask Barbara about using the bathroom. Somebody else, I always wonder how bus drivers cope.
That is a bit of a problem. That can be a bit of a problem. You see, there's a main depot in town. Like, there's a central control in town. So behind Cleary's is our main, what would you call it? Like the main canteen. The bathroom there. So a lot of the buses stop around there and you take your breaks around there. So you have to walk to break there.
Okay.
A lot of the hotels and bars are very kind to bus drivers. They let us use their bathroom. But, you know, on most routes, there are no facilities at either end. So you just kind of have to grab it when you can. And sometimes, but then again, you just call control and you say, listen, I have to stop and go to the loo. And they go, grand, no problem.
Okay, so there's no big deal.
They'll adjust the real time, maybe, that you might be 3 or 5 minutes delayed or whatever. Like, I mean, if you've got to go, you've got to go. So, that is an issue, especially with the women, you know, that, like, they need the bathroom or whatever.
It's a human right, Barbara. It's a human right.
Absolutely.
Ryan, I'd like to feel so much safer knowing your guest is driving the bus I'm on. Sounds like a Wonder Woman. Thanks from Ray. Another says, Barbara is driven. Well, she is and does the driving. Fair play to her. She deserves it. Good on her. She's an inspiration this morning. And another says, I'm delighted to hear Barbara, that female bus driver. My daughter is a student teacher in Marino, and it gives me comfort to know that Barbara's driving and that she's so nice on the bus route. The students call
The
students call your bus the 1, 2, 3 for the Moon Tory.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
That
stops just near my house there all day. I see all the students getting on and off. So it's just lovely, like, to be. It was really surreal, like, driving through Marino on the 1, 2, 3 on Sunday. Like, really surreal, and I just felt so proud and. you know, what a full circle you come, you know. It's just amazing. And you just kind of have to take stock as well and go, do you know what? I did this. Like, I did it. I've, you know, my income's secure, my family's secure, everything's good, and this is a great company, and I'm really happy I did it. And you just go through the process and...
Yeah,
no,
but
do
you know what?
I can do it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it didn't just land on your lap. You saw the ad. You had the guts to
go for it.
You know, that really took guts too. And now you're there. I don't think I've spoken to anybody with such job satisfaction in such a long time. So I'm so happy to hear you do that. They're lucky to have you. And
thank you so much, Barbara.
It's a real pleasure to. I'll see you on the 1-2-3. I'm sure at some stage.
Thanks,
soon.
Brian. I'll give you a beep. Yeah,
yeah,
no
do please. Okay. Thanks, Barbara. Nice to talk to you.
Take care. Thank
That's
you.
Barbara Shannon. What a great, happy, upbeat story. That's just what the world needs on a day like today. I think it's good news and fair play. I've seen those ads looking for recruiting female bus drivers, but little did I know I'd be talking to one such occupant of the big seat this morning. So thanks to Barbara for that at about 18 minutes to 10. And Niamh Condon is our guest this morning. Good morning, Niamh.
Brian, good morning.
Nice to talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. All good.
Can we go to the butcher shop? And you were 12 years old and you were there doing what?
Oh God, I was there doing everything you could possibly think of.
Yeah.
So between delivering messages for customers and preparing meats, so I could be in charge of mincing some pork to make sausages.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to make sausages when I was 12 and 13. And then watching my uncle butcher the lamb carcasses and every other kind of meat, and listening to him talking to the customers about how to cook it.
So is this Jim Nevin's Deli in Ennis?
That's right.
And people, of course, of Ennis will know what and who we're talking about. But you were very young to be looking at, you know, even the words you're using, like the butchery and the carcasses. And a lot of young people might look at that and go, oh, that's not for me. But you saw it as an education, really.
It was an education, and he always said to me, I'm teaching you life skills. And I told him at the start, I don't want to be a chef. And he said, if you can cook, you'll always have a job. Now, he was right, but I wouldn't tell him that.
No, you didn't want to give him the satisfaction. But you did it anyway, and you were going to school. And we'll bounce on to the Clare Inn Hotel then. It's now called the Inn at Dromoland. You were 17 years old. It was 1997. What class of glamour were you dealing with there?
It was a different world completely. First of all, I had to actually annoy the general manager there for a job.
Okay.
For about 6 months before he gave in. And the glamour that I was given when I arrived in was a bucket and a scrubbing brush, and I had to clean underneath where the ovens were and basically scrub the kitchen.
That's pretty tough work,
it was. But I, again, as I did, I was kind of pushing myself forward. So I kind of told the chefs, if you're under pressure, ask me and I'll give you a hand. So the head chef there at the time, Colm Chalk, saw me, I suppose, kind of pushing myself forward and trying to learn more and get my hands stuck in the food side of it. So he brought me in and trained me as a chef.
And at last, you were now in this role in life that you had, all roads were leading to. And you went to UCC, you did food process engineering.
I did.
What does that mean?
It's a combination of food science and an engineering degree together. So when I went in, originally, I was greenhorn. It was like a calf at fresh grass, to be honest with you. I went to UCC and I let loose. So we were studying everything from zoology to mathematics, to physics, everything you can think of.
Yeah.
And then we did AutoCAD drawing. So I was intrigued with that because for my Leaving Cert, I did construction studies.
Right.
So I would have had an interest in the building side of things as well as food side because my dad was a plumber.
Right, you're covering so many angles here. Okay.
Yeah, so my dad was a plumber and I would have always been out with him on jobs to see what was done. And I would have been asked to hang a radiator at one point. You could see people's faces when they saw me wire a time clock. It was kind of a bit strange for them. But for the building side and the AutoCAD drawing, always stuck with me. So design and features and how things run, which as well is part of process engineering, because process engineers will design a plant, so a production plant. It could be a food production or it could be pharmaceutical. And they will design from the raw materials coming in to the finished product going out and what process it has to go through to get to the end result.
Okay, and this is all relevant to where we're going here because it is. Because
it doesn't sound it at the start.
No,
but it
no,
is.
No. It's like a mad painting. But we'll don't worry. They'll see if you stand back further enough, you'll see a lovely landscape in a moment. And that's what this is in your head because we're talking food, but we're also talking design. We're talking education, but we're also talking engineering. And with that in mind, I want to go to the nursing home you ended up as head chef in 2014. This is Fairfield Nursing Home, and I think from what I understand, you went into that going, yeah, you know, I'll just do, you know, eggs in the morning, you know, a sandwich in the afternoon, you know, dinner in the middle of the day and then a bit of a light supper in the evening. You know, a bit blasé, would that be right?
Very much so blasé, yeah. I was sold a different picture to what it was. So the owner there, Sean Collins, called me and he said, look, Niamh, I have a role here and it would suit you down to the ground. You'd have a lifestyle that you've never had before where you work 9 to 5. The cooking is easy. You'll do that in your sleep. Mm. I said, okay, 9 to 5, that's great. No chef has ever had that type of a job, so off I went. And it was a massive eye-opener. So it was all fine when he was telling me the job role until I spoke to the director of nursing.
Yeah.
And she said, right, okay, we have 50 residents, they have to get 3 meals a day, but out of those 50, there might be 25 people with a swallowing difficulty. We also have people with diabetes. We need low-sodium diets. We have renal diets. I nearly cried.
Yeah, so 50 residents, 3 meals per day, and as you say, half of them nearly all individual meals, really. So it's a totally different ballgame for you.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Now, yes, there was a menu, and yes, we kind of stuck to that as best we could because it wasn't possible to cook 50 different individual meals. So we modified each. Let's just say it was a roast beef dinner on today. So for everybody that could eat roast beef as it is, that was fine. So anybody that needed anything modified, like you needed to have it cut up smaller, then that was done. If you needed it minced, that was done. And if you needed it pureed, that was done. When it came to presenting it, that posed a problem for me.
Okay, and we'll come to that in a moment. But as you say, half the residents with swallowing difficulties, and there was a particular syndrome that you came across for the first time in your life.
Yes, it's called dysphagia.
Yeah.
And I couldn't pronounce it, let alone tell you what it was at the start.
Yeah, you and me both.
And I know, it is a mouthful. Pardon the pun.
I know, under the circumstances, but come on, we'll keep going.
But what it means is people have a difficulty from getting the food into their mouth, holding it in their mouth.
Yes.
They could have a difficulty in chewing it, moving it from the front of their mouth into their stomach. So there's a range of difficulties that these people have.
Because they could choke.
They can choke and they can aspirate, which means something can go into their lungs.
All right, okay.
And from me, when I started, I said, am I going to get any kind of training on this? And they said, no, sure, you'll figure it out. Because there was no training. It's not their fault at all. It was basically there is no training for chefs in care homes at the time when I started on how to prepare food safely for someone with a swallowing difficulty.
So what do you do, Niamh, with that piece of or a slice or two of roast beef for somebody with dysphagia?
So what I ended up at the start was I followed suit from the previous chef that was there before me. So I put everything into a blender.
Yeah.
And made a smoothie for all the world. So it was like a baby bowl.
All right.
And it was served in either a blue bowl, a red bowl, or a green, whatever colour bowl, but it was still a bowl of brown stuff, only word you could call it, because it didn't look like anything. And people were, they were eating it because, okay, you know, they'd nothing else. But I just couldn't sit down and sit there with somebody else and eat that same meal. I just thought it wasn't fair.
Yeah.
So we decided with the jigs and the reels and lots of conversations and lots of research online, how do we do this better? So I came up with, let's try and scoop it individually. Let's give a scoop of carrot, a scoop of beef and a scoop of potato.
So rather than lashing it all into a blender, throwing it into a bowl and saying, good luck with that, that's your dinner in the middle of the day, you say, no, hang on. This needs to be a bit more dignified.
We break it down a small bit.
Okay.
So we did it in stages, so everything was individual. And it looked fine. I thought, at the time, I thought, okay, this is an improvement. But when I went into the dining room and I sat down with one of the residents to eat the dinner, she refused it point blank. And I thought, what's going on? She thought it was ice cream.
Okay.
And because it was hot, savoury, and totally not what she expected, she refused point blank until she got ice cream. Now, my issue at the time was she had a certain swallowing difficulty, which is a level 4, which we can talk about in a second, that she could not have ice cream because it will turn to liquid in her mouth and she could choke. So I had to go back to the kitchen again and try and come up with something cold enough to resemble ice cream to give to her for her to have her dinner.
I'm laughing thinking about your initial saunter into the nursing home. Going, yeah, a few spuds and a bit of meat, I'll be grand. I'll be home at 5. I'll be back in time for Emmerdale, so listen, it'll be grand. As opposed to, what? I have to put this into that beside this, and that's just meal one. And you did something very, like, actors have the Stanislavski school of drama where they really inhabit the role. You did exactly this when you spent 3 days just eating dysphagia diet. And what was that like? I mean, did you blend everything? Did you serve it up to yourself in different ways? Did you treat the family to this? Or how was that for you?
Well, they were looking at me and they said, you're on your own there. So it was actually a dietitian who was working for Nutritia at the time. Her name is Grania Kent. And we just down to getting to know her, and actually, I think I frightened her. I dragged her into the kitchen one day in the nursing home. I said, I need your help. My worry was that when we blend food, that we reduce the nutrients. And I wanted to see how we could try and improve it. So we decided together that we would do this diet of 3 days, pureed food and thickened liquids. So we did it here in my house, where we prepared all the food. And yes, we prepared them individually. Okay. And I gave Grania a set of piping bags filled with food that equally that I had. And the challenge for her was to present the food in a way that was attractive for her to eat.
Okay, so you've got a piping bag full of potatoes, a piping bag full of meat pureed, and a piping bag full of parsnips and carrots pureed.
Yeah.
And her job was to make that look edible in a way that you might think, I might enjoy this, as opposed to edible because I have to eat.
Yes. And the reason I did that is because a lot of the clinical staff are able to talk about dysphagia and they're brilliant, and I would highly recommend talking to them. But to actually get them to do the practical side of it, it's a different story. So when she started plating and I started plating, there were two different plates of food with the same food. And she wanted my plate and I ate hers.
Okay, because?
Because the plate that I presented looked like what it should in comparison to hers. And that was down to piping skills and obviously trying to make the food look exactly like what it was. So if it was a carrot, I'd pipe a carrot to look like a carrot.
The shape of a carrot?
Yes. Actually, potatoes are potatoes, so yes, they don't have to be any particular shape. But meat slices and
so you're, I'm looking at a picture of it here. So you're piping the food like an artist might do a sculpture of a carrot or potatoes. So the colours are right.
Well, that's very kind.
But really, the shapes are absolutely bang on. But really what it is, it's pureed food masquerading as the real thing.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And the difference for that was to see people eat their food and to see the empty plates coming back, and the care assistants who are saying, God, it's so much easier now to help people eat their meals because they want to eat them.
But isn't it funny? Like, ultimately, this is just the mind playing tricks on us, because the same food is going in.
Yes.
But the visuals make the food attractive or enhance or increase our appetite.
Yes, 100%.
Like, the psychology here as much as physiology.
I suppose it probably is. But there's a lot more to it. Like, the more I've done with this, the more I learn, and I'm still learning. There's something new every day with this type of cooking, because, yes, you have to cook it and puree it, but you also have to worry about water leaking from it. So if you blend soup, just take soup, for example, and you leave it there for a while without having any flour or anything like that in to bind it, eventually you will have the food sink to the bottom and the water flow to the top.
Yes.
The same goes with if you blend carrots and any other food, to be honest. It will leak water in time, because water will always find its level. I'm going back to the engineering now again.
Yeah, you are. But that's why you're so good at this, because you've got this background. And then When you were doing your, when you were living the pureed life, if you will, why did you get looks, people looking at you when you ordered an Americano in the coffee shop?
Yeah, because I had to have a commercial thickener in the food. So yes, it went into purees, but it had to go into drinks for safe swallow. And the reason behind that is it slows down the flow rate of the liquid going into the stomach, so it does not go into the lungs. And for that, I had to have a tin of powder which resembled either artificial sweetener or sugar. And to get the drink to the correct consistency for me at the time, I had to add 7 scoops into the cup. And people were looking over going, Jesus, would she stop with the sugar? That was number one. And number two then, because it reached its consistency, it was like a thick custard.
Galoop.
So I had to spoon that and not drink it.
As your coffee. How was it?
Different. It tasted the exact same. There is no difference in taste. It's just the sensation of something a lot thicker in your mouth if you're not used to it.
Did you, if I may bounce back to your piping skills, did you at any point think that maybe moulds would be the answer? Shapes of moulds. I mean, and it's almost like a kid's plasticine set or something. Or is that a silly question? I'm not sure.
No, not at all. I did, and it took me a while to source them. I sourced them in Australia.
Okay.
And the reason I was looking at that is because not everybody had, obviously, the piping skills. Like the dietitian, she struggled with piping.
Yeah.
And the staff, like, I was the only chef in the kitchen, and I did have help. And the help I had were fantastic. So there was one other person in the kitchen with me who were responsible for everything. So anything that needed to be done, they were responsible. So I tried to ask them to help me to puree stuff and obviously to plate it up, but they struggled with the piping. So when I wasn't there, I was concerned, what are these residents getting and what does it look like? So that was the reason for me looking for food molds. So we prepared the food fresh, chilled them down, pureed them, and put them into these molds, put them in the freezer, and then we had a stock of carrots, sausages, beef, cauliflower. We had everything in the freezer.
People need to go on your Instagram page, Dysphagia Chef, at Dysphagia Chef, to see your masterpieces, because they really are, they are remarkable. And I got a lovely text here from Annette saying, listening to Niamh this morning, would you give her a huge thank you for everything she did for our mother when in the nursing home? She changed mum's life.
That's so lovely.
Isn't that amazing?
Annette contacted me about a month before her parents' 50th wedding anniversary. And she said, what can we do? We were just in the middle, just starting with COVID. Can we do anything? And their travel restrictions were in. And Annette was living in Cork City, and it was about an hour's drive for her at least to travel to Fairfield in West Cork.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I can make a cake, but I don't know what else I can do. So she contacted her dad and her brother. Her dad was suffering from early onset dementia, and her mother was in the nursing home. And her mother's name is Anne. Anne and myself, she was such a character. She bounced all these things. So if I was to come up with some new recipe or modified something, I'd go down to Anne and I'd ask her, Anne, is this okay? She'd either say yes or go back to the kitchen. And I made a cake for her. So it was their 50th wedding anniversary, and it was a fine big cake, but I had to modify it because Anne was suffering with a different form of dysphagia. It was a level 5, which was not puree. So we modified the cake, and I took it down to the bedroom. Her husband was outside the window. We couldn't even open the window to the poor man. He was looking in at her, and she was looking out at him, and Annette was on the phone to me saying, will you take as many pictures as you can? Which I did. And eventually, I said, Anne, would you smile at him? Jeepers. So she was laughing, and he was looking in the window, and just one moment, we actually caught it on the picture, and it's beautiful. It was all over the media, actually. It was on a lot of newspapers, and Annette herself was on the radio talking about it. But that time that we did that, it made such a difference, clearly to Annette and her family, and obviously then to her mother and her father.
Amazing, and touching lives like that, Niamh. It's so impressive. I've really enjoyed our conversation this morning. I feel like I've learned an awful lot. I'm enlightened as to the world of pureed food and piping food and moulds and making life
and
easier for people.
It's amazing as well, Ryan, that it affects so many people that people actually don't realise that they have an issue with it. Because it can range from everything from motor neuron, Parkinson's, dementia, obviously.
And they're all writing in this morning with the text. Niamh, thank you so much for your time this morning. Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks a million, Ryan. Talk
nice
to you soon.
Not at all. Thank you very much indeed. And lots of texts in on that. We'll get to those. For your texts, I'll get to them in a moment, but I want to say a very good morning to Gabriel Gatehouse. Good morning, Gabriel.
Good morning, Ryan. What a lovely Beatles tune you played just then. I was really enjoying it. I don't know that one.
A lot of people have got stuck into the Beatles again since the magnificent Get Back documentary.
Yeah, loved it.
And it was so nice about that, Gabriel, as well, is as I'm a McCartney guy, and the amount of Lennon people have come up and said, okay, I've got to admit, McCartney was pretty good.
And what great hair.
Hair. I mean, there's a whole podcast waiting to happen of Beatle hair.
How did that happen?
I don't know. From mop top to greasy hobo. You know, I mean, at one stage, it's funny. That's one of the reasons that the attraction of McCartney in that program is because he's the only one with a light behind his eyes half the time. There's a lot of dead-eyed sort of, God help us, stupefied looks. But the hair, the amount of grease would make a chip shop blanch.
I know. I know nothing about the Beatles. I'm sure your listeners don't want to hear me waffle on about them.
Oh, sure. They're used to me doing that for years, for two, so it's enough. Anyway, Gabriel, I'm very happy to talk to you because I really did. I gobbled up The Coming Storm, your podcast.
That's so good to hear. Thanks.
Yeah, I really did. One of my brothers sent it to me and said, I find the best recommendations I get are word of mouth, actually. Is that what you find from people? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way I get all the best things are word of mouth. Yeah. And actually, what we found with this is that, you know, no amount of promotion, and thank you for plugging my show on your radio show, but actually no amount of promotion gets you listeners the way that just people word of mouth recommending it does.
Yeah, and the reason it's doing well by word of mouth is because you have put it together so well, and you've told quite a complicated story in a most accessible and actually quite dramatic way. I was talking earlier on about I'll just watch the beginning of the next episode of a box set or whatever. With yours, it passed that wonderful test where you say, I'll just listen to the first 5 minutes of the next episode. That good.
Thanks.
Okay, let take us to the genesis of it, Gabriel. Why did you decide QAnon needs to be investigated, researched and broken down? Talk to me about that.
So I'm a BBC foreign correspondent. I work for Newsnight on BBC Two, and I was covering the 2020 presidential election. So this is before the whole storming of the Capitol and all that. I was in Arizona just after the polls had closed, a couple of days after the polls had closed, and there were some protests, pretty small protests there, of a bunch of Trump supporters who believed that there was something fishy going on. Mm. And there was this really eye-catching guy there. He had like these horns on his head. He was draped in furs. He was bare-chested. His face was painted, and he was sort of yelling and stuff.
Sounds familiar.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I'm a TV journalist. You know, it's a visual medium. I think this guy looks great. So I go over and have a little chat with him. And he's friendly enough, but the story he tells me is pretty crazy, right? So he believes that the election has been stolen by a cabal of satanic paedophiles who are in league with Hillary Clinton and they're trying to unseat Donald Trump. And so I thought, look, this guy looks amazing, but what he's saying is just too niche and too crazy. I can't put him in a news report.
Yeah.
So I made the huge mistake of not interviewing him on camera.
Yeah, I love that. It's a strain throughout your podcast is that you kind of harp back to it a couple of times, go, but I totally understand journalistically why you chose not to, because you don't want to give too much craziness, too much oxygen.
Too much, exactly. Yeah. But then, you know, 2 months later, I'm back in London, I'm watching TV, there's a mob storming the Capitol, and there he is,
the same
guy with the horns. And I was in the newsroom, and I was going to all my colleagues, I was like, that guy, I met him, and now he's there. They were like, oh great, where's the interview that you must have done with him? We can run it now.
Yeah, yeah, where's the interview, Cassandra?
Exactly. So I was kind of that kind of journalistic fail, really, that led me down that road. And I started trying to figure out, you know, where did this come from? How did this crazy narrative that, that you'd think, from my perspective, anyone would see is just too weird to be true, right? I can understand why people have conspiracy theories about John F. Kennedy, who shot John F. Kennedy, you know, maybe that, like, blah, blah, blah. But the idea that there's this vast conspiracy theory involving law enforcement, politicians, the FBI, the judges, electoral officials, journalists, Hollywood, all to try and unseat Donald Trump, it's just, you know, it just, to me, doesn't seem believable, but so many Americans believe it, right? Millions and millions of them, according to polls. So that was really my mission, was to try and find out where that come from, how it took hold of the American imagination. And the conclusion I really came to is, don't ignore the weird guy.
Yes. I was intrigued by that analysis, and that's why, you know, even our conversation here starts at the end. The shaman essentially sitting in Mike Pence's chair in the Capitol, and then you say, but how did we get here? How did a guy wearing these skins with his tattoos and his hat and his roaring and yelling, how did any of this happen? So then you bring it right back. And I mean, I'm of an age where I remember very, you know, I'm 48 years old. So Clinton, I was in college when Clinton got elected. I was all excited that he was kind of our generation's Kennedy almost, you know, young and interesting and played the saxophone and wore Ray-Bans and went on Saturday Night Live and what have you. And he gets into the White House and, you know, then the first big hurdle in some ways was Vince Foster. So remind us who Vince Foster was and how does he fit into this story?
So Vince Foster was an old friend of the Clintons from back in Arkansas. He was a school friend of Bill's, and he'd worked with Hillary at a law firm in Little Rock. And so when the Clintons went to Washington in 1993, they took some of the old Arkansas buddies with them, and Vince Foster was one of them. He was a lawyer, and he became deputy White House counsel. So he was a very senior lawyer in the Clinton White House. And almost as soon as the Clintons got into the White House, all kinds of little petty scandals started sticking to them. So, or not sticking to them, but sort of buzzing around them. And then Vince Foster winds up dead in a park. And almost immediately it's clear that he's shot himself. But the conspiracy machine, the rumor machine, starts going into motion, and the rumors are, the conspiracy theory is, he was murdered. Who had him murdered? Ooh, maybe it was the Clintons. Maybe he knew too much. Too much about what? Well, we don't know, but too much about something. He must have been doing something very big for him to wind up dead. And this is the beginning. Like, it's not true, right? Just to be clear.
Yes.
Committed, investigated. It's pretty clear, committed suicide. But this narrative about, he was murdered, and maybe he was murdered by the Clintons, and maybe the Clintons are these kind of murdering duo. That was the beginning of something that later became called the Clinton body count, which then morphed into part of this whole story of evil Hillary and her satanic cabal taking over the world for evil purposes. So we kind of took the Vince Foster story as our ground zero, if you like.
We
could have gone back further, right? We could have gone back to the satanic panic in the 80s. We could have gone, you know, but you have to take a starting point, and it seemed like a good a place as any to start.
Right. Now I want to go into the dark weeds of the internet, which was starting to become this extraordinary force in people's lives on the planet Earth. And I want you to talk to me about, you know, the virginal wizards. And I want to, you know what I mean? And these, we're getting into the weirdo territory. But like I say, I'm not actually mocking, because you...
No, that's very important.
I think it is important, because that this was part of your thesis, was that although, yes, they were sort of, a lot of them were basement dwellers, and a lot of them were into, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog and you know, and you know, almost Nazism and weirdness, they suddenly started to acquire this anti-power, or I don't know what you want to call it, Gabriel, but bring us there, please.
So this is, it's QAnon started on this website called 4chan, which is an image board. It's a bit like a social media site, except everything is anonymous, right? So all the posters are anonymous, and you post images, pictures, and text. And this, it was kind of the it was really the dark underbelly of the internet in the noughties, and by the kind of the teens, if you like, of this century, it was this really dark place where, you know, kids who weren't kids anymore and were still living in their mum's basement were getting into far-right ideology, far-right images, porn, sometimes images of child abuse, like this really dark stuff on this website. But also there was this kind of tradition of what's called LARPing, and LARP stands for live action role play. And it started off as a thing in real life where people, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons, I don't know if that rings a bell with some of your listeners, but people would, you know, pretend to be characters from epic heroic characters, and they would dress up and blah, blah, blah in real life, right? But then it moved onto 4chan, and it became this thing where people pretended online to be highly placed insiders. So before there was this conspiracy theory called QAnon, before there was this poster named Q who was saying stuff about this battle against the deep state cabal, there was FBI Anon, there was CIA Anon. So there were all these kinds of people who were pretending to be highly placed insiders in positions of power, revealing the secrets that explain the world. And the people who were consuming this on this website, right, they all kind of know. They kind of know it's a joke, it's a game, but at the same time they're kind of playing along with it, right? And that's where QAnon comes from. But something happens with QAnon whereby it jumps from this very niche website where the users are quite savvy and they know that maybe you don't want to take it too seriously. It jumps onto the mainstream internet. It jumps to YouTube and Facebook and Reddit. And there, out there, there's this whole other bunch of people who don't know that this is... that there's a whole tradition behind this, and they start taking it seriously, and that's where QAnon really begins.
And then you have that extraordinary rhyme and lack of reason with Trump getting elected democratically. Sorry, we shouldn't say, you shouldn't be so judgmental on that. Democratically elected. But he's flirting with Q as a phenomenon constantly. You know, do you believe these guys? You know, who think that the whole world is being run by pedophiles, and the Clintons are in a Pizza Hut or a pizzeria somewhere, with their friends doing unspeakable things. And he says, well, you know, they say some good things, and I'm up for protecting kids and stuff like that. So you have this conflation of the most senior politics in the world and the most junior conspiracy theory wacko in the world, and they're now allies.
Yeah, I mean, Trump just has this... I'm almost certain that he didn't know... There were definitely people in Trump's orbit, that this is what we found in our reporting for this series, who were pushing QAnon, both in... in 2016, it was the kind of the predecessor of QAnon, which is the Pizzagate theory that you just referenced. But in 2020, it was QAnon. There were people who were pushing it because they thought it could help him electorally. I think Trump himself really didn't know what it was, but he's got such a canny instinct for where he might find support that, you know, he doesn't want to alienate these people. And you're right, there was that amazing clip where a reporter asks him, you know, what do you know about this QAnon thing? And he kind of goes, well, I don't know very much about it, but I know they like me very much.
Good people.
And then the reporter goes, well, the theory is that it's this cult of satanic pedophiles who are secretly, that you're helping battle against this cult of satanic pedophiles. Does that sound like something you're into? And he goes, well, I don't know better. That's supposed to be a bad thing.
Oh, Lordy.
So he's very canny, but what is interesting, as you say, is the kind of the linking of these people, this man with huge power, with these kids with no power, right? And that, or that had no power, and what that's what one of the aspects of this that is so interesting. Why did this thing come about? Well, and why did it come out of this place from these people who felt powerless because they felt they were in their mum's basements as sort of young adults, not just because, you know, they're weirdos or whatever. They were in their mum's basement, a lot of them, because, you know, economically they didn't have any prospects. They maybe couldn't afford to move out. You know, that the world is changing, the kind of the kind of economic stability that their parents might have enjoyed and they might have expected simply doesn't exist anymore. You know, they can get, maybe they can survive with 2 or 3 zero-hour contract gig economy jobs. You know, so these people are feeling powerless. And this whole idea of LARPing as a person in a position of power, that's a role-play game. They're role-playing powerful people because they have no power. And then suddenly, their little story that they made up gets yoked to this incredibly powerful force.
Extraordinary.
And that's kind of what happened.
And Trump, you know, to his credit, as you say, a canny operator, sees this socio-psychological zeitgeist and says, yeah, okay, they're part of my tribe. I'll mind you, I'll lead you to the promised land. Even if you are dressing up as real people, we'll LARP all the way to Capitol Hill. And we should just explain, of course, that QAnon was allegedly sending messages from essentially the Oval Office or the corridors of power. And those messages dried up then, and whoever was posting them, and I think you got pretty much close to who it was in the end a couple of times, disappeared. Because the whole thing, I mean, this is like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. There's a twit, yeah. There's a twit there pulling levers.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't us who kind of discovered who it most likely was posting as Q. There were a few other journalists who sort of did the work, most of the work on that before we got there. But it turned out that at least certainly most people think that it was this father and son duo called the Watkinses, Americans who were living in the Philippines, who eventually acquired this website where Q, this figure of Q, was posting. Most people who looked into this believe that they were controlling the Q account, as it were. Mm. And you're right, they stopped posting after the election in 2020. But the movement itself has sort of has had a second life. So it's kind of moved on from just being about the sort of cabalist attack, pedophiles, Hillary Clinton, and it's kind of linked up with the election was stolen, which is, you know, yes, Donald Trump's rallying cry and continues to be. You know, he's still holding rallies saying that. Then, and you know, now in the Republican Party in America, it's hard to say that you don't believe the election was stolen if you want to have any future in the party, even if you don't believe it, right? Yeah. Because you would have to believe that they somehow stole 8 million votes.
Yeah.
Right, that's a lot of votes to steal. That's
because they're scared. They're tethered to the Trumpian goat. I mean, they're scared out of their wits to lose votes if they go against the.
Some people are scared of Trump. Yeah, we spoke to people who said, I spoke to this one guy who was a sort of Republican old boy from South Carolina, who was one of the few who said to me, "Of course, I don't believe that the election was stolen. I mean, how do you steal 8 million votes?" But he said, "I've never seen such fear in people." Yeah. Like, I've never seen such devotion to Donald Trump, and I've never seen such fear. So the question is, like, what happens now to American politics, where you have, you know, there are only two parties in America, and one of them doesn't believe in the integrity of the electoral system anymore. Mm. Mm. And how do you come back from that?
I don't know. And even in the reports last week are saying that Hillary Clinton is sniffing around for maybe another look at this. People close to her saying we could have a complete rerun of the 2016.
Can you imagine that?
Can you Gabriel, this is your job in foreign affairs. Can you believe such a prospect, or has the world gone so Alice in Wonderland that we can't say no to such an option?
I mean, you're right. The world has gone pretty crazy in the past 5 years. I would think it would be folly. It would be such folly to rerun the 2016 election of Trump versus Clinton. Yeah. It would just be such madness.
When did history ever get in the way of folly?
But well, exactly. And when did powerful people's egos ever get in the way? Of
correct,
folly?
Correct.
Say never.
One other observation. I'm kind of running out of time. I could speak to you for another hour and a half. But one other observation was how, you know, Michael Flynn, the former army guy, was. He's kind of a de facto leader of this nebulous QAnon phenomenon, going to the rallies and so forth. So they now have a sort of a human manifestation of the online idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because these conspiracy theory communities, they're quite febrile and they move quite fast and they turn on each other and they have schisms and splits. So actually, since we spoke to him, Mike Flynn fell foul of a group of QAnon conspiracy theorists because he led some prayer somewhere that they thought was an incantation to the devil or something. So I'm not sure how much of a leader he still is for the QAnon community, if you can even call it one thing. QAnon is basically a spectrum, right? It's a spectrum at one end where you're like, oh, there's something dodgy about the 2020 election. And at the other end, it's they're eating babies and drinking blood. And there's this kind of, there's everything in between. And Mike Flynn, Mike Flynn is one of the very colourful characters, General Mike Flynn, who sort of inhabits that spectrum.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm so glad to talk to you this morning, Gabriel, and we'll talk again.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. I look forward to your podcast on beetle hair, but that's for another few months. I'm sure it took you a while to put that together. Gabriel Gatehouse, congratulations on your podcast, and we'll talk again. I hope soon. Best of luck with everything.
Thanks so much.
Not at all. Gabriel Gatehouse joining us live from London. The programme called, the podcast called The Coming Storm. It comes from BBC Radio 4, as Gabriel was saying. He's the BBC Newsnight's foreign correspondent. But I hope you found that as fascinating as I did. That podcast is a knockout. All right, you've got a Eurovision song to play. We'll do it after this. There I was watching one of my favourite comedy programmes on television, Curb Your Enthusiasm, with Larry David. If you haven't watched it, great. So he's a curmudgeon. A misanthrope who goes around and stuff happens to him that's really annoying, and people hop in queues and whatever it might be, he just gets perpetually irritated by everything. And I see this guy coming on with his proper Dublin accent, like he's not hiding it or trying to put on some fake American accent or whatever. Like, who's this guy? Turns out his name's Glenn Keough, and then Glenn got in touch with me on Instagram to say, here, the sisters heard you talking about me on there. He said, great, great, great. He said, like, let's have a chat. And he's in California, he's in the United States, and he's on the phone now. Glenn, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you? Happy Friday from Los Angeles.
Yeah, from LA. Good man. It's a good day in Ireland. I hope it's a good day in the United States, even if it's early in the morning. But congratulations on your Curb success. I'm intrigued to hear a bit about you. Tell us about yourself.
Thanks, appreciate it. Yeah, look, I've been over here for 15 years, born and raised in Newtown Park in Blackrock, and then moved down to Australia in my mid-20s, and was down there, started acting down there. I was actually an accountant in Ireland, believe it or not, CPA for my sins, but then I grew a personality and got out of that game into the world of acting when I was in Australia. And then from down there, I was lucky enough to win a green card in the lottery to move out to the US and give it a go after I'd kind of done my education in the Actors Workshop in the Conservatory down in Brisbane, Australia, and then moved out here 15 years ago and just been hacking away at it since. Yeah, living in Los Angeles and enjoying the lifestyle.
So give us a list off the TV shows we'll know that you'd have a part in, regardless of the size of the role. Name drop away there, liberally.
Yeah, I've done a few. Sons of Anarchy is a pretty big one. Criminal Minds, NCIS, Ray Donovan, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., show called Scorpion. I was on Magnum out in Hawaii there late last year. And then I made a fleeting voice appearance in the latest Spider-Man. My footage didn't make it, but it's good to be part of that juggernaut. And then I was in the Transformers movie before that, so... You know, I've been lucky enough to walk, Ryan.
Yeah,
I've been chipping away at it out here, and I've been lucky to get some work.
We'll get to Curb in a moment, but the Spider-Man film is so big. What happened? You did film stuff on camera, but yet you're still in the film. Yeah. What happened?
Yeah, look, they flew me out to Atlanta, and I shot out there for a week, playing a British reporter, a roving reporter on the scene, and we shot the footage. It was great. And you know, I expected to be in it, but when I went to the premiere and sat down with my popcorn, I didn't appear on screen, but I heard my voice. So I'm in the movie per se, but just not my ugly mug didn't make the cut, you know. Yeah. But happy to be part of it.
Stick it on the CV. It all counts. It all counts. You know that.
Exactly. Well, see, that's what happens when you have a face for radio. You probably know something about that yourself.
I can tell.
They don't put you on the screen.
I wrote the book. So obviously, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Not everyone knows what it is, but those who don't know that it is a phenomenon, and Larry David is one one of the great comic writers of our time, no doubt about it. Where did this come from for you? And did you know what you were getting into and all the rest? Because it all looks so... It kind of looks unscripted or ad-libbed, the way the acting is kind of... It's kind of peculiar, but you can see them kind of half laughing at for real, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and it is Ryan. You know, Larry David, the writer, creator, and the star of it, he wrote and created Seinfeld, right? So hugely successful. It's a big show out here. It airs on HBO and Hulu. And I hadn't actually watched the show, to be totally honest with you. It'd been on the air. This is season 11, but it was on for 10 years, and then it took a break for a few years and then came back. And I'd heard of it, but hadn't watched it. And then an audition came through last year from my agents to put myself on tape, because we record on tape now. There's no in-person auditions. And they sent me a scenario, and I played it out. They were looking for a prim and proper British prop master, you know, and I'll be honest with you, I went snowboarding the day before, first time ever snowboarding, if you've ever had the pleasure.
No.
You know, I didn't take any lessons, like a typical paddy, went down the slopes, almost bruised every bone and muscle in my body from my toes to my ears. And when I went to audition, I was in so much pain, I just made the quick decision that, you know what, he's going to be an angry Irishman as opposed to a proper British man. So I put myself on tape, and then, they cast me, and it was great. And like I say, it's unscripted. They give you a scenario. You go in, for example, you know, my character Stan approaches Larry to complain about the young actor on the show. And then you play it out, and it's pure improv, and you do a new take each time. You know, and Larry was fantastic to work with. And, you know, each time it just gave him a new take. He kept laughing in my face, kept telling me to do the same thing. You know, because it's on HBO and Hulu, you know, you can drop a couple of curses here and there. So I took liberty with that, you know. So probably not one for the mammy to watch, but fantastic experience. Like, it was a laugh, you know.
Oh, you're great. You're great in it, Glenn, I have to say. I love how you curse like a proper Irishman. It's not like Americanized, you know what I mean? It looked like I felt like I was looking at a fella who was really annoyed properly.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've all worked with people like that in all walks of life, Ryan. So I pulled from previous work experiences to portray that character. But yeah, it was great banter, and there was no hold barred. They let me play it exactly as I wanted to. There was great collaboration in there. Worked with an actor called John Rudnitsky, who was on SNL out here for a season. He was fantastic. He played young Larry.
Yes.
And then, you know, Ted Danson was on it, Tracy Ullman. But Larry was fantastic to work with. It was just a joy, you know, and hopefully they bring me back.
Yeah. Is Larry David, is he a nice fella? Pleasant off air, on air?
He is, yeah, he was lovely. You know, we shot out obviously during COVID times, and he'd had COVID last year, I believe. So, you know, when we weren't live, he was masked up and kind of keeping his distance from people, and I totally get that. But once we played and we went live, like I said, it's unscripted. You don't rehearse. You go straight into it. He just kind of handed the microphone over to me to run with it.
Okay.
You know, and the biggest challenge was him just cracking up at what I was saying. He was trying to wrap his head around it, you know, as to where are you coming from? You know, I wasn't familiar with any of the Irish terms like crack or banter or what have you. And I had to kind of explain that to him offset and then go back into it again, you know. But he's a lovely guy. And look, he's hugely successful. And the show is fantastic. Like, I'm a big fan now, not just because I'm in the show, but, you know, it's brilliant. Like, there's some brilliant characters on that show.
So here, I'm going to play a tiny clip of this is you and Larry, and Larry's at the doing this thing in this particular episode where when somebody's boring and we start singing the music like in the Oscars to try and get them to stop.
You're telling
a story that you've obviously outlived about an uncle in Gory or whatever. We'll have a listen and see. And in case you hear the humming, Larry's bored.
My uncle Michael wanted to say hello. He used to work for you on Seinfeld. He was a transport guy.
Really?
For a couple of months, yeah.
How's he doing?
He's doing okay. He's back in Ireland. His grandfather passed away, so Michael had to go back and take care of the family farm, you know. So he went back. He's got about 60 acres of land, about 65 miles outside Dublin, a place called Gory. It's got a ton of cattle, sheep dogs. You know, he's a prize-winning potato grower now. Could you believe that? He's doing a fantastic job. He's selling them all over Europe now. He's making really good coin, you know. But Michael's not around anymore. But I, he's working like a Trojan, and he's very grateful for what you did for him, and he's, you know, just wanted me to say hello to you. So anyway.
So you that's a great bit of riffing from you, in fairness to you, Glenn. You see, you had to riff and bore him to tears about your uncle.
Yeah.
That's great.
That was actually the toughest scene to shoot, Ryan, because they asked me deliberately to bore him to tears. Come out with a boring story, and the previous take, that was the second take. The previous take I mentioned to you that my uncle Michael from Gorey, you know, he'd got gout in his leg and lost his left leg, and Larry cracked up at that and he said, "No, you gotta to keep in the scene what we're trying to do here, you gotta come up with something boring." And I'm like, "Jesus, on the spot, what kind of a story do you tell that's boring?" So that's why I just came up with this uncle that used to work in Seinfeld and whatever. And but again, it was, you know, from a take like that, they'd give me another 10, 15 seconds walk off set, come on with something fresh and new, which was, you know, it was just a joy. I've done a bit of improv in the background, so it was great, man. It was great.
That sounds great. And what about acting in Ireland? Is that, do you want to, or it's the gigs
I'd
aren't
love
there?
To, you know, like when I left Ireland, like I said, the career started in Australia and then I moved out here, but I've never actually worked back in Ireland.
Oh.
You know, I go back a couple of times a year, summertime, Christmas time. I've just got a new agent back there, Anne Curtis, shout out to her.
Yeah.
Great lady, and she's starting to pitch me out there, which is great. But I'd love to walk back there, Ryan, back there in the UK, and some fantastic stuff being shot out of Ireland now, you know, like the quality is top notch. So I'm always available.
Great, you know, and you've got as we know, your sisters are here. Is your mother's here too?
Yeah, my mum Mary, she's in the nursing home back there in Dublin, hopefully listening now. And then I've got four sisters, three of them on the ground there in Dublin. You know, that's my PR agency, you know, my free PR agency. Yeah. They pick up, and that's they heard you mention me earlier in the week on the show. So
great.
I've got a big family back there. And if I could just mention my nephew Ryan Kyo is actually representing Ireland right now. Flew out to Abu Dhabi. He's an MMA fighter. He fights for SBG. As trained by John Kavanagh out there.
Oh, Coach Kavanagh, nice fella, yeah.
Yeah, Coach Kavanagh, yeah. So Ryan won the World Championship
last
November. Yeah, he's 21 now, so he's fighting in there's another World Championship out in Abu Dhabi. So he travelled out there and is, representing Ireland. So best of luck to him. You know, but I've got a ton of nieces and nephews back there. Try to get back a couple of times a year, as I said, and... Yeah, can't beat the banter back home.
That's for sure. Well, look, I hope that your CV is chock-a-block now with experience, and you're ready for Ireland's ready for you to come back and get some gigs here with any luck. So good luck with it all, and we'll see you when you're back on the island. Glenn, thanks for your time. Really good talking to you.
Okay, thanks, Ryan. Take care. All the best, mate. Take care.
You're okay. Okay, there's Glenn Keogh heading into the Californian sunset. Good on him for joining us, and he's, as I say, featuring in a few episodes in the most recent series of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which, if you don't know it, is one of the best things on TV, because just when something goes wrong in your daily life, you hear the music in your head. I think we'll give the Eurovision song a run out after this break. It's the finals of the six songs that we have been offering for your delectation, with a view to seeing them all perform on the Late Late Show on our Eurosong special on the 4th of February. And then we, as members of the voting public, will be able to decide who we send to represent Ireland in Turin, Italia, in May. Back shortly. Una, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
It's nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me on.
And we are talking to Una Niganila, who's the editor of Belfast. We spoke about The Crown, which feels like 100 years ago now. How long? I've got to,
I think it's 5 years ago, yeah.
5 years ago. Well, look, you're just going from success to success, so congratulations. I got to see Belfast during the week. It is a thing of beauty.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, tell us, so yourself and Kenneth Brown, you have form?
Yes. We were working together actually on Death on the Nile whenever the COVID restrictions began. I was over in England doing that with him.
Yeah.
And once the COVID restrictions came, the studio shut down. So I asked Ken, could I come back to my studio in Dublin, my home in Dublin, in Medbrook? And the husband and children were with me in England. They had moved over temporarily for Death on the Nile. So then we all came home to Dublin, and I finished Death on the Nile at home in Dublin. And when I returned in June just to sort of officially lock off with Ken, he presented me this beautiful script and said, if it's your cuppa, I'd love you to cut it. And I saw the title Belfast and read it that night. And then immediately I emailed him that night just to say, wow, you know, I couldn't believe that he'd actually written it during lockdown so beautifully. He had captured the vernacular of the people of Northern Ireland, the humour, the pathos. I just thought it's representative of my family. My dad's from Oma in County Tyrone. And I'm sure for loads of Irish people and actually people around the world have sort of said they can recognise themselves in the humanity of his story. So I was just like, yes, please. I would love to work with you on this.
Well, the reviews are in this morning. The papers are so... The Irish Independent, Paul Whittington, gives it 5 stars this morning. I mean, there's the Mail. I think I saw another 5-star review in this morning. So it's certainly impressing the critics. There's no question about that. So congratulations on that. Can you give us a nutshell for people who haven't seen it clearly? What is Belfast?
So Belfast is it's a memoir film based on Ken's childhood. He was 9 when his family left Belfast in 1969-1970. So the film is a portrait of his experience for that year of his life as his father, who was working in London, realised that the troubles were brewing and he needed to move his family to safety. But the mother, Katrina Balf, she was crippled with not wanting to leave because Belfast was her home and her community. So it's really an intimate story through the eyes of the child. So sometimes we didn't focus too extensively on the details of the troubles because it's shown through the child's perspective. So that allowed us actually to focus on his biggest dilemma was how to sit beside the smart girl in the class, how to be with his granny and pops who he loved so much. So it's really a celebration, I think, of the beautiful city of Belfast, the community of neighbours of all persuasions, because Catholics and Protestants were side by side. And the intimacy, I think, of the family who lived separate yet together, because granny and pops are a vital part of Buddy's life, but they lived down the road from him. And I think that's what sort of chimed with me, because I said to Ken, I'm Pa, you know, sometimes I'm commuting to London. I'm leaving the children at 4 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And my parents live around the corner from us. And Danny and Naomi would just, you know, run down to them. So I think there was a lot of fabric of authenticity and truthfulness that he captured that probably resonates with many more people.
You're right. It's the end of childhood, the end of innocence in some ways explored in all of this. In black and white, that beautiful monochrome, which I absolutely adored, because then you see Judi Dench sitting down watching a film in the cinema, and her glasses, you know, we're looking at a black and white audience, and yet in her glasses we see the reflection of the screen and it's colour.
Yeah. So that came very naturally, because Ken had this idea of the beautiful velvety black and white. It's not the social realist black and white. It's actually quite a beautiful, deep, rich black and white. Harris Amber Lucas was DOP. But he always wanted the cinema to be in colour. So we actually had 3 films, but we dropped one of them, The Great Escape, just due to the nature of editing. The first cut was 2 hours 20, so we refined it down. And then it meant that the theatre, which had been in black and white, we just thought, well, maybe that should be colour as well, because it's about what inspires the child. And then the little reflection in the glasses came very naturally, actually through a conversation with myself, Ken and Matt Glenn, of just thinking maybe Granny deserves that little motif, whether it's the fact that she also, as his grandmother, maybe she loved theatre, or maybe it was a barrier that she couldn't see through. There's many interpretations, but we just thought it was nice to give it to her. Yeah. I like to think it's because she also had the sort of poetic soul that Ken has, that maybe theatre was important to her, and that's why she was given that glimpse on her glasses.
I'm mocked, Una, over in TV, particularly by my toy show colleagues, because I'm always trying to... I love the transition from black and white to colour. Obviously, The Wizard of Oz was the first... I remember watching The Wizard of Oz and seeing Kansas become Oz. And as I think about it, talking to you, my mind is still blown by the childhood innocence of seeing that transition. And equally, when the little lad, Buddy, the young Kenneth Branagh character in Belfast, goes to the cinema, having had this kind of, he's kind of half seen the troubles in the background. He saw a riot over there. He's hearing his folks rowing about whether they should leave Belfast or not. And then they sit down and they watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And the car is going over the cliff, and the wings, are they going to come out? Is the car going to fly? Because of all the black and white, the vividness of the colour
is it, like it? It just
it's extraordinary.
Oh, I couldn't. I was watching, going, wow. And even the people in the cinema in on the film are leaning forward with
forward,
the car,
yeah.
And then the car lifts off. They're leaning back again. And go, whoo, we're up. You know,
yeah,
the magic
like
of
cinema.
Yeah, it's like the magic
yeah,
of
the, but magic.
The magic of cinema, the escapism, the color, the excitement of it all. Why and the shared experience in
yeah.
You know. Oh, anyway,
and you know what I think that's actually a really good point about the shared experience, because obviously through COVID all the cinemas were closing, and I had a film Misbehavior that opened on March 13th, 2020, just as all the cinemas closed. So I think Ken also, he really instinctively, cinema was a huge relief for him as a child.
Mm.
So to celebrate that, and actually I hope people do go to cinema to see this, because he used sometimes wide shots with the depth of field. So you know the scene when Buddy's on the outhouse talking to Pops about the girl Catherine, and Granny's at the back of the shot, she's way down through a window.
Yeah.
So that on the big screen is going to be just joyous, whereas on the little screen, if it came, you know, it will still look good, but it's really beautiful on the big screen. But we had fun because, you know, I edited all of this remotely because of COVID. So I continued after I came back to London in June, and we mixed Death on the Nile. I then returned to Dublin to cut Belfast. So Ken had an avid in his house. I had an avid in my house. My assistants had avids in their houses. And we worked together sort of forensically, you know, exploring the material, moving things around. So I was going to just tell you one thing which you might find interesting.
Yeah, please.
The first cut colour, for example, was a conversation with Ken and I of just, OK, how can we make that the most dynamic that it could be? And we used to have a beautiful exterior. It was a lovely VFX shot of a beautiful old cinema. But we found that as we were cutting, we were moving scenes around, that maybe they had more psychological or emotional weight if they moved. So the scene with Pa talking to the neighbour about you can't be a lone ranger, and we moved that scene up earlier, they leave out the bin. Now that's when we used to cut to the cinema, and we found that actually when you lingered on the bin and then cut to this vivid orange explosion, I hope I'm not doing a spoiler, but it just gave such an impact, again, from the point of view of the child who had just witnessed that riot 10 minutes earlier. And that seemed like a really great way to celebrate the introduction of colour in the 1969 world.
Oh, it's beautiful. A very, very subtle moment when on Christmas morning when the camera pans over a game here and a football there, and then Agatha Christie. I saw what you were doing there, because obviously Kenneth Branagh is Poirot in the most recent incarnations, and there you are finishing Death on the Nile, and you know it was a beautiful, but I believe Ken Branagh's mother was a big Agatha Christie fan anyway.
Agatha Christie fan, she was, yeah. And actually those were all Ken's Easter eggs. He had them even in the script, the Thor comic and the... The only one I thought was quite funny, the Tottenham Hotspur, the Bond. I thought Bond was funny. I thought that was a good one.
Yeah.
But Jamie Dornan is now being sort of touted, I think, so... That seems like it.
Oh, I love that, though. I love that playing games with us. I mean, Agatha Christie would have approved. Here, listen, I have to ask about Death in the Nile. I can't wait. I'm so excited. Actually, I think James Bond was such a good film last year. I think in the COVID, the couple of years, the films have got very earnest and very heavy and kind of, you know, I'd probably shoestringy budget, but just it's been very heavy couple of years cinema-wise. But I cannot wait to see Death on the Nile.
I know, it's beautiful. It's 65 mil, so it's a 70 mil print for people, and it's beautiful. It's Emma Mackey, if people remember her from Sex Education.
Yeah.
Gal Gadot, Ken Branagh, Annette Bening, Arnie Hammer, we've got everyone, Russell Brand, so it's a beautiful, but it's really good fun. I love Agatha Christie.
Good. So it must have been lovely to edit that.
Yeah, because I was like you or anyone else growing up. We used to go on holiday to Dunanway, so my mum and dad always had like Agatha Christie books or Alfred Hitchcock's The Three Investigators, if anyone remembers them. So I'm a huge Agatha Christie fan. So I'm looking forward to that. So that's 11th of February, that's coming out.
Oh, totally. But Una, congratulations. You're doing Trojan work, in fairness to you. I'm so impressed and so happy for you and your family. It's a great achievement, and I really mean that.
And thank you, Ryan. And can I say, I just say, Glenn Keogh was amazing because I loved Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, great.
When I was there, I've seen Three Girls, which is on Netflix now, which is such a somber TV show about the Rochdale scandal.
Oh, yes.
Curb Your Enthusiasm. I was watching that every single night because you needed a little bit of relief after all the intensity.
Yeah. Oh, do you know what? That's go on.
Yeah. I was just going to say, can I do Glenn Keogh and just say hello to a few people, because I know there's so many during COVID, because I was working from home with Belfast, you know, my mum and dad, Donal and Katrine Donnelly in Meadowbrook, and my husband Julian and the kids Danny, Naomi and Andy, my godson, they were all so brilliant, and we sort of pulled together. So the schools as well. I just wanted to thank the teachers and staff of Saint Tractus in Meadowbrook and Gonzaga College. Yeah. And also for my sister, all the team who work in St. John's God's Island Bridge. Like, I'm very mindful that while I was out seeing Belfast, you know, the COVID pandemic was just affecting so many people and so much hardship. And we're making this film about compassion and community and neighbours, the love of neighbours. And I just thought all of us sort of came together. So I just wanted to say, pay tribute to them, because they all work so hard, and, you know, they don't sometimes get the... I think now we're giving everyone the credit that they deserve, but sometimes we forget to do so. So I just want to say a huge thank you to all of those, because I think hopefully this film will be a nice release after such a terrible 2 years that we've all had and the losses that we've suffered.
Well said, Una. Really well said. And you're right. And there's going to be a lot of gratitude that needs to be handed out around this country and in the days and weeks to come. Congratulations, Una. Belfast is a beautiful... Rose, I should say. And Death in the Nile, cannot wait to get my hands on, only in the cinema. I will not watch it on any other format.
Thank you.
And keep it coming. Okay, best of luck to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Ryan.
Bye. Bye.